$20 if you went to, for each service at two different addresses. Now, as Senator Brenneman said, it is possible to get $40 for serving two people at the same address. However, the open market competition won't allow that. Specifically, that was addressed by several people in committee on the House side, and an amendment was introduced to negotiate for private process service by contract.
Why do we need the language at each address then? It's $20 for each party served, regardless where. If you have to go to more than one address to serve a party, and they give you several different addresses to try, and that happens occasionally, doesn't
That's correct.
It? Are you to get $20 for each of those addresses that you call upon, or $20 when you finally serve the person wherever he may be?
Yes, I can only speak for myself, and I would interpret that to mean that you get $20 for serving that particular person, regardless of how many attempts you make. As a matter of company policy, we always make attempts at least two locations, regardless of the number. We might make 15 attempts to serve a person, as long as it isn't at more than two locations.
So you'd have no trouble with deleting the language at each address so that it would read that for serving summons, et cetera, $20 for each party for which service is requested?
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Brockman.
I'm reading the staff measure summary from the House here, and it says under major points discussed, the market should assist in determining what fee a process server should receive, and then you have concurred with that. It says, thus a maximum fee should be established, but not a minimum fee. Doesn't this just set a flat fee right here? Were you a party to the proceedings in the House when that issue was brought up?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Well, this just says it's going to be $20. It doesn't say up to.
Well, the continuing language says $20 for each party at each address for service, unless the process server has contracted separately for a lower fee with the requesting person. Yeah. Am I interpreting what you said correctly?
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shoemaker.
Let me pursue that then under sub B then, for serving notice of seizure and sale of personal real property, writ of restitution and so forth, yeah. It does just call for a flat $20. It doesn't give room for negotiating a lower fee. I assume that's not what you intended.
That's correct, because that pertains only to the sheriff.
Oh, so that one is statutory and there's no capability of reduction. Okay.
Further comments?
Okay.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Beth and Jim Markey, why don't you come up at the same time? Introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Mary Raymond, and I am the current president for the Oregon Association of Process Servers. Basically, I would like to explain that 2415 is supported by our group, as there hasn't been a fee increase in 8 years, and we feel that it is time. I'd like to shed some light on things that have been talked about here. The reason that we listed $20 for more than one address is recently we have had an influx of one small claims. Husband and wife have recently divorced. Wife lives in Malala and husband lives in McMinnville. It requires two process servers, and that was the reason it listed at per address, because it was one action, but they had since split, and that was the reason at one address was listed that way. Basically, at the House committees, the reason that we went for $20 and then process service fees was negotiable was the sheriff felt that he could not negotiate. He needed the $20 fee it to be flat, because when you go in and file your papers, the clerk says, are you going to have the sheriff serve it? They say, great, make out a check for $20 and then deliver it to the sheriff's department. If she said, well, it may be $20, but then again, it may be $15 or $12.50, depending on what the sheriff says. You're going to have to go down there. There would be a lot of confusion, because also, on the papers, there is a line that says service fee shall be, and that needs to be filled out by the clerk of the court, unless it is filled out by the collection agency. Hence, why the $20 was a flat fee for the sheriff and negotiable for process servers only.
Okay, Sergeant Shoemaker.
So then, if I hear you correctly, it's not intended that if you serve two people at the same address, you get $40?
That was not the way that it was initially set up to be. My understanding from what went on in the House was you do have this case where husband and wife are no longer together.
I heard that, but if they are at the same address, then...
Personal, this is just my company policy. No, if they're the same address, we serve them for the $20 fee. And I would assume that that is the company policy of most of the people in our association.
So we probably need to fix that.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Yeah, maybe Jim Markey will get to this. Line 20, changing from sheriff's fees to any fees. What is the significance of that change?
That was introduced by Mr. Markey's group, in the fact that it had only covered sheriff's fees. It hadn't covered process servers. And so we deleted the word sheriff and made it any, so that it could cover anybody's fees.
Okay. Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of Oregon Collectors Association. Collectors Association is in support of House Bill 2415. It was our amendment that had been requested in the House relative to allowing people to contract for a lower fee if they desired. We think that's good public policy. With respect to lines 20 and 21, the reason for the amendment deleting sheriffs and adding any, and also the reason for some proposed amendments which I have to this bill that I believe you have in your possession. We have a serious concern about collection of post, what would be termed post-judgment costs. The ORCP defines a cost as that which is incurred in the prosecution or defense of an action. But once you have a judgment, you no longer have an action. You are enforcing the judgment. There are many fees expended in the enforcement process, but there is no statutory fee presently for charging those fees back to the debtor, although that is the common practice among all private debt collectors with the Department of Justice and all other state agencies. Those fees are charged back. This line 20 and 21 is about the only statutory reference to recoverability of those kinds of fees, and we made it any fees. Since then, we have worked with the State Court Administrator's Office and had developed amendments to House Bill 2930, which set out basically a method whereby these kinds of costs could be recovered without a judge actually adding them to the judgment and a clerk needing to docket them. As I understand it, the Court Administrator's Office has a concern about clerks adding things to the judgment that may come in on a writ without anything being signed by a judge. There's a certain amount of liability there, and they don't want the clerks entering into that kind of activity. So the amendment simply would allow for statutory authority for a judgment creditor to recover costs which were incurred in the enforcement of a judgment, either by garnishment or other means. And it sets out standards by which creditors must conduct themselves. They must provide reasonable notice and the like to the judgment debtor. And we've actually listed the fees which are recoverable so that In every case, they are a statutory fee. We're not going to allow creditors to recover. Again, this language is contained in 2930 with a couple of exceptions, and on page two, or excuse me, on page three and page four of the amendments, there is some underlying material there that is not contained in 2930, and that involves collecting, recovering these monies through...
Could you tell us where that is?
On page three and page three, line six, we've added the word attachment or payment.
Oh, I see, the underlined...
Yeah, the underlined sections.
Okay.
Okay, those, the amendment is adopted in House Bill 2930 in the House, allowed for the recovery of these costs through a garnishment proceeding, but had we left out the possibility of collecting those on an attachment or other type of payment. And so we've added that by amendment in 2415 and with a conflict amendment to 2930, so that if 2930 should pass, it would be further amended to add those. That was just a method of doing this so that you didn't have to go back and also amend 2930 if you desired not to. So if you adopted these amendments to 2415, you could move 29, if both bills passed, you could move 2930 without further amending it in this committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? I have a... I guess I have a... Who's going to sort of make sure that these, that there's some understanding of the actual fees or disbursements, and who's finally going to make the decision on whether it's appropriate or not?
To collect the fees?
Yes.
First of all,
the fees in fact were used.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, on page two of the amendments, line five, this section allows the recovery only of the following statutorily established monies that meet the requirements under subsection three of this section. So in each case, it would be a fee which is authorized by statute, clearly. That's not the case now. There are people adding fees out there that aren't authorized by statute. And this would prohibit that practice. So we think it's to the debtor's advantage in that case. However, the debtor has a right to a hearing of exemption on this matter the same as he would on any other matter. So if he thinks the fees being collected back are inappropriate, he can simply file for a hearing of exemption and claim that those funds are exempt. So it's in a hearing of exemption, the same as any other. If a plaintiff takes money that the defendant believes he should not, he files for a claim of exemption and gets a hearing, and that's the same process here.
Senator Grinsky.
I've always wondered something, Jim. At the present time, expenses that are incurred through the process of garnishment, attachment, execution, and all that, how are you recovering those at all? Or are you recovering them at the present time, or do you have to file another action to try and pick that up?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Grinsky, they are recovered. There is a continuing, what is known in the industry as a continuing cost bill, which is incurred, and they are collected back. There is no statutory authority for doing so. Now, I will also say there's no statutory prohibition on doing so. The writ of garnishment has a line to add the service fee for the writ, and it has a line to add other costs, and so they're added on that and simply taken. But that line on the form, and the form is prescribed by the statute, so the form is in the statute, and the line is in the statute. That's the only authority there, and we think that's pretty weak.
I agree that that's probably pretty weak, but this continuing cost bill, is that something you get the judge to authorize? Because your concern is going to be that, and has been, I'm sure, that the clerks are unwilling to allow executions on things where they're the ones determining the cost. They want the judge to authorize that stuff. So how's that work once you've had your cost bill entered?
We've alleviated that by allowing, see, the only thing you may add are those fees authorized specifically by statute? And we've enumerated those statutes.
In your amendments.
Yes, by the amendment. So, and the clerk is out of it at that point. The clerk doesn't have to docket those amounts.
That's the problem that you're trying to circumvent with the amendments.
Right, yes, yes.
So at the present time, once your cost bill's entered, that's it for you.
That's right.
Other than that line in the garnishment that you were speaking of.
I believe under the law that probably there is an amended cost bill that should be submitted and should be docketed, but I don't think that's actually occurring out there.
That's what I was going to ask you, is if you are ever doing that where you have to continually incur further costs and you're not able to pick them up necessarily. I'm wondering if you've ever tried submitting an amended cost bill.
Well, that's been done in some counties, but most counties don't docket them, I don't think.
Further questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
I don't have anyone else sign up on House Bill 2415. Representative Maddox is here. Has requested that we turn to House Bill 2573.
Madam Chair.
Session.
On 2415, I took the liberty of penciling in some suggested amendments to correct that misunderstanding regarding the $20 for each party. And also one other respect, maybe if I could just leave that with Catherine, she can look it over.
Appreciate that. Representative Maddox.
Madam Chair, I'm Kevin Maddox, State Representative for House District 32. I don't know whether or not you want to hear the full bill or if you want to have the rest of the hearing a little later this morning.
Oh,
I appreciate the courtesy.
Let's do it together.
All right.
It would be my intention to take up House Bill 2573 with everyone who has signed up and the moment we just have Winnie here. Thank you.
We also have a representative of the Oregon Restaurant Association as well as the Oregon Food Bank here.
Okay.
Basically, what this bill does is address the situation in Oregon where there was a very limited bill, a gleaner's law that allowed some fresh food to be provided by gleaners to others, but it was so limited that most food service establishments, restaurants and grocery stores felt that their potential liability in donating food to charitable organizations or to third parties who would then provide the food to the needy was such that they were unwilling to do so. And in Oregon, we have tons of food being destroyed every week rather than donated out of fear of liability. So this bill basically says that any food establishment, and it's defined to include restaurants and it can include grocery stores or any kind of establishment that provides food to the public, that wants to provide food to either a food bank or directly to a charitable organization, may do so that as long as the food is wholesome at the time of the donation, they incur no further liability. They do not need to be worried about packaging requirements and labeling requirements. In fact, that is often the reason why many canned goods, for example, are disposed of because the labels are off of them or the labels are damaged. It's designed to protect them other than for gross negligence or intentional misconduct. It's designed to create this barrier to liability just so that food which is currently being destroyed will be made available to charitable organizations and to needy individuals. The food banks come into this because there are different kinds of food banks. Some of them do require a shared maintenance fee from the participants, and we tried to define this very carefully, working with various groups so that restaurateurs and grocery stores would feel very open and complete about the food that they would be willing to hand over. On the other hand, that food banks and similar organizations would feel comfortable passing on the food, receiving the food, and so forth. Supporting groups include the Oregon Food Bank, the Oregon Restaurant Association, Fred Meyer, Payless Northwest, St. Francis Food Train, Osberg, and other than saying anything else, I'd like to ask Winnie to pick up.
Madam Chairman, I'm Winnie Nazarko. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Food Bank. We're located in Portland. I won't belabor this bill because I know you have a lot of work on your agenda. But I'd like to talk briefly about some of the things that I think that are important about it that will be supporting our ability to do the job that we have to do in the state. One thing in particular is the explicit addition of canned goods to the protection offered by the statute. We have had experiences where individuals who control sources of canned goods that could otherwise be offered for donation have told us explicitly that because they were not covered under the existing liability protections, that they were unable to make contributions. So that will open up that field for us. One of the ways that we feed people in the state of Oregon also is by sorting through salvage, food that may or may not be good. We at Oregon Food Bank take it and make a discrimination as to whether it's usable or not. And because of the fact that this bill addresses liability in terms of gross negligence, that will also open up an incentive for potential donors to contribute to us where we can make the further discrimination as to the suitability of food to be passed on to those who need it. The addition of food that is prepared, food that may be fixed in restaurants or other commercial establishments of that type, is a very important one, too. Currently, restaurants are unable, with any sense of safety, to be able to make food available that is perfectly edible, perfectly safe, but they don't feel that it's a wise thing to do. St. Francis Dining Hall in Portland has started a program called Food Train, which explicitly pulls on those kinds of donations and then uses that kind of food in order to run a soup kitchen kind of arrangement. So expansion of protection in that area would serve as incentive for other organizations of the same type to make those kinds of contributions. So therefore, we would like you to support this bill. Our 600 member programs would like you to support this bill, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Madam Chair, also Russ Spencer is here from the Oregon Restaurant Association from the other side of the equation.
I guess I want to ask Representative Maddox a question. On line 12, regardless of compliance with any laws regulating packaging or labeling, and regardless of compliance with any laws regulating storage or handling.
That all relates to buy of the food by the donee after the donation. One of the concerns has been that, well, what happens when I pass this food on to you and you smash up the packaging or you tear the labels off, and then someone later on is going through the code that's stamped on the can or whatever to say, well, that came from Fred Meyer and accused me of having done something wrong. So if I hand it over to you in good condition and you as the donee do something with it that is not indicated, that I won't be responsible. That phrase, by the donee after the donation of the food, relates to all of the prior statement.
Okay. Thank you.
I have
Senator Shoemaker.
Some questions. I think, let me start by saying I think it's a good bill. It's a good idea, and I congratulate and thank you for coming up with it. My questions, I think, have more to do with clarity and making sure that I understand it, and if I don't, maybe clarifying it within the statute. In sub A, where you have gleaner after quite a lot of verbiage regarding a donor, it was unclear to me exactly where the gleaner fit in. I wonder if it would be improved by just saying, notwithstanding any other provision of law, a gleaner or the good faith donor of any food, and then just go on with the section.
Yes, I think it would read better.
I think that would,
Senator okay. Shoemaker, I agree with you. Sometimes we get so deeply into this legislation where we're working on it that you can no longer see the forest or the trees. I've been so heavily involved in this, I wouldn't have picked up on that.
Yeah,
I see
that's
what you
exactly
mean.
What I, same thing I would have done, too, just as you move along. Down in line 16, you provide a protection from civil or criminal liability, but you don't extend that to the gleaner. Did you intend to?
That's a good question, too. There had been no discussion of the gleaner in that provision because there had not been such a provision before, but I would agree with you, since we're including gleaners in sub A, we ought to include gleaners in sub C.
And in 22, we talk about protection from criminal penalty or civil damages from the condition of the food. And you make it available to those who distribute it at no charge or on a fee scale reflecting ability to pay, but you don't include that other standard, which was only requiring a shared maintenance contribution.
That is an error.
Okay.
In fact, frankly, when we worked over the bill on House Judiciary, I am sure that we talked about putting that phrase in here, and this had not been picked up. Frankly, when I carried it to the floor, I didn't even have the A. and Gross version in front of me, and that phrase was supposed to be in there.
Okay, good.
Because we have gone out in the hallway, as a matter of fact, and worked out that change and had agreed on it. Thank you for noting that.
A question of substance on that, and I realize that this subsection really doesn't substantially change existing law, but I'm a little worried. You have the receiver of the food who now passes it on to the needy, and it protects them from liability fairly absolutely. But what if they just allow the food to sit around and rot? Now, that you could argue is, maybe you could argue that's gross negligence, but you certainly have a dispute there. I wonder if there ought not be some standard of care that would protect against carelessness in terms of handling the food before passing it on by the donee.
The concern there was that these intermediary organizations are charitable organizations, nonprofit organizations, and they therefore don't have the profit motive behind them and likely don't have the same amount of insurance behind them, frankly.
Yeah.
So that...
Well...
But I'm not finished here, though.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make sure that they met at least the same standard of care as the donor, and we did... Basically, we said the donor is protected except for gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional conduct. So we said, well, we'll apply the same standard of care to the intermediate organization, which is recklessness, gross negligence, or intentional conduct. And that was simply a policy statement that we expect that these organizations are, first of all, the food that gets to them is wholesome, and then they're supposed to be passing it on to others. And we simply applied the same standard of care as would be applied to the original donor.
Yeah, I think the difference is that the distributor, the original distributor, has to distribute food which is apparently fit for human consumption. So that's a standard that applies at the point of the gift. Whereas the recipient, the middleman, if you will, doesn't seem to have that same standard. Maybe we should put in there
and distribute it
apparently fit for human consumption and while apparently fit for human consumption distributes it, so that we impose at least that same standard.
It was the intention to impose the same standard of apparently fit for human consumption,
okay.
And I would agree with amending it to make it that much clearer.
Okay. And then I think my final point is over on the next page where you define donor to include any person who operates a restaurant or other food establishment, and I think that's good, and what you're trying to avoid, I guess, is not include donor just a private party who has a party at his house. That maybe is going a little far. Because
that is correct.
How about a caterer, however?
Caterer is a food establishment licensed by law.
Is it?
I mean, well, if it's, there may be some caterers who are not licensed by law.
But this is only
caterers who are licensed by law.
Okay, so then they are included as a food establishment.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
I think my question is answered with the second to the last issue that Senator Shoemaker raised, which was, you know, admittedly there are good charitable institutions. There are also charitable institutions that are not very well necessarily careful about what they do or necessarily staffed to prepare that, and I guess I'm not sure that that makes them any better for it, and I think if they're going to be in the business of being a charitable institution, we ought to hold them to some standard as well. In fact, we had that big debate in another committee on restaurants and licenses thereof. So that piece, I think, is important from my standpoint. Any
Mrs.
other questions?
Russ Spencer.
I'll be very brief, Chair Cohen. Russ Spencer with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I think we've touched on many of the points that are concerned to our association. We support this bill 100%. It will enable our operators to participate in charitable functions that many operators have been hesitant to participate in previously. For example, in Eugene, we have a group of restaurants that have gotten together to provide food at a shelter once a week. Each restaurant will provide that food. It's been difficult to recruit additional members for fear of the liability resulting from the donated food. This should remove those concerns, and we should be able to have our operators participating in these type of programs throughout the state much more readily. And we appreciate Representative Mannix's efforts on these behalf, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin?
Madam Chair?
Yes. I'm
willing to come back later after a couple of legislative matters for the last bill on your agenda. There's some different parties involved. If that's all right, I'll just be back in about an hour.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, let us move to...
Does he know that we adjourn at 10, which is...
Well, he may. You will find out. Let's move to 2421. And, yes, 2421. Charlie Williamson, Jan Bache.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jan Bache. I'm a trial lawyer from Portland, appearing on behalf of OTLA.
Yeah.
We are in support of House Bill 2421, which removes the immunity of public bodies agents who negligently injure